afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. Hey, do we have a sponsor?
What do you have for us, Bill?
Yeah, we do have a sponsor.
I heard it might be those Pape Machinery people.
Oh, yeah, man. They're everywhere. Yeah, Pape Machinery. They're your local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And you want to go up there, they've got lots of tractors in stock, implements, mowers. They got it all. It's all green. Go up and see them. They also have full parts and service available. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And do not forget the swinging deal on generators.
Oh, they got a swinging deal, yeah.
Well, there you go.
While they last, just a little FYI, Honda is having a problem supplying generators to California right now. So thank our local governance for that, because they put some restriction on them that makes it a little difficult to sell in California now. So,
What a surprise.
Yeah, you got to go out of state to buy certain models of Honda generators.
Probably going to catch you at the border.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to keep your power on. How dare you?
They'll impound your generator.
They want you to be in the dark.
You'll
be in the dark.
Yeah.
Ugh, idiots. Uh-huh. But meanwhile, everybody can smoke pot and drive their car.
Yep. Go back to your cave.
I guess, spoiler alert on the show. Meanwhile, okay, so Dr. Drum, not to utilize any more time, because I know you have a ton of information. So, for the folks that missed the first hour, we definitely don't have to recap the whole thing. But you're talking about the impaired driving task force that should be set up now. I mean, shouldn't it be working now? Shouldn't all of this, all these recommendations, all of these things? Well, actually, hold on. That's not even what I really. That's not even true. This should have all been done before they legalized marijuana.
Exactly. I mean, if you're going to legalize a drug, maybe we ought to keep track of the ramifications.
Yeah.
From the get go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think any other state that's falling into this trap needs to be fully aware that you're absolutely right. This needs to be done before you let a hallucinogenic substance out onto our roadway. The sole purpose of using marijuana is for its hallucinogenic effect, okay? It's to alter one's brain. That's the purpose of using marijuana.
And this isn't – we're not talking about the marijuana of the 70s.
2% THC.
Yeah, 2% THC. This stuff is potent.
Right. We're talking easily in the 20% for the joint, if you will. And then these vape pens. And shatter and wax and other things that they're selling now in our dispensaries today, the marijuana, you know, drug dens that are there. I actually don't like calling them dispensaries. I call them what they are. They're actually drug dens. That I wouldn't recommend anybody to go into, as we already talked about the illicit chemicals that are on these products. I think you should probably wear a hazmat suit if you're ever considering and a ventilator. If you're ever considering walking into those rooms, because again, these are loaded with pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, things that, and then people are consuming these, they're smoking this. Again, the state's been caught not testing, and when they did test, they found that the testing labs were fraudulent. So just buyer beware. It's your state, not the federal government, that is in charge of this. The federal government has said this is a controlled substance one, meaning there's no medical indication for it. Its risk is higher than its potential benefit, and that it has an addictive potential. And all of those things we know to be true.
Well, so if I go into a drug den and I purchase some of their products, and it's later found out that they do contain a pesticide, and I ingested those
pesticides. Or rodenticide. Well, if you ingested the rodenticide, I guess you'd be dead. So,
yeah. Do I have any recourse if I purchase something that could potentially damage me, or do I have to prove that it actually did before I can go after them for selling me poison, basically?
Yeah, I'm a pharmacist, not a lawyer. I think I'd refer you to a lawyer for that. But I strongly encourage people to start collecting the evidence of where you purchased that product, because as we know, the tobacco industry was hit by a few lawsuits as a result of them selling their product for many, many, many years. And those people that were able to prove what brand, what product they purchased, stood in a better stance there in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
So I would strongly encourage the parents to start collecting receipts and packaging. So that way when it comes back, oh, you can't prove you bought my, you know, Tommy's Best High marijuana product. You can say, yes, we did. Here's the receipt. And here are the packaging that my child then used your product. So I would start collecting that evidence, is what my recommendation would be. Again, I think ask the lawyer as to how they would best recommend you handle that. So to get back to the groups, our task force recommendation, again, we had a recommendation the state should actually perform shall analyze all collected DUI and DUID data for the purpose of developing better methods to screen for and prevent DUIs, and that they shall publish this on an annual statewide report to guide the future direction of DUI and DUID policy decisions in this state. That must be done. They've been getting away with this for 25 years with legal marijuana. We have to have statewide reports that are available to the public to start looking at this data and doing some analysis. I don't know that we can necessarily rely on the state to perform the adequate analysis that I would strongly encourage that this information needs to be put out there. They could easily blind the individual's information. You don't have to put the person's name on there, but you can say where the crash occurred, what the blood levels were, what the, you know, the oral swabs, the time of day, you know, what substances were found, how many people were injured, how many people were killed. All that information should be out there, whether it was raining, was it sunlight, what time, you know, all that information could easily be put out there. It is with the FARS database. They have to report that into the federal government. We should have a database in this state as well, and it should be actually even better than the FARS database.
Right.
So that's kind of the data recommendations that our groups had. We also had a section called Cannabis Consumer Education Recommendations. It's not only for the consumer, but also for other people. So really I would call this section our education section, that the state should provide responsible sales and consumption practices training to all cannabis retailers, cannabis consumption lounges. And by the way, there are consumption lounges allowed in the state of California, meaning you could go there and use your marijuana in a room. In which a group from UC San Francisco did an analysis of the air in that room and found it to be extremely toxic. Extremely toxic.
Really?
To be inside of these rooms. Yeah, UCSF did a study in some drug dens over there in Berkeley and Oakland, and they reported this at the 2019 North American Cannabis Summit. You can go onto the website and find that, 2019 North American Cannabis Summit, and you can find that presentation and review the data that came out of UCSF on how toxic the air. And I would think that the workers that work in those lounges might have a nice case against these groups.
God, you'd think so.
That they, as workers, are being exposed to this and might be able to bring up a workers' comp claim against the organization.
We still have OSHA running around fining companies because they saw an employee not wearing a mask. I mean, it's ridiculous how they pick and choose which industries they're going to pick
and what's considered dangerous.
Yeah, what's dangerous? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this was astronomical levels, and they were doing things with whether it be a joint smoking or their volcanoes. That they were using other means that they were vaping. And the vape, oh, just by the way, the vape toxins that are coming off are no safer, really, than smoking a joint. So that was information that was out. So, again, the training needs to be done with these people that are selling these products. And, again, even the home delivery services, which, again, I might add, the state told us that we could prohibit in our cities and our counties, but then they turned around and allowed delivery services without our consent into our cities and counties that voted against marijuana. Just an FYI, that happened after Prop 64, that your state government allowed that. But they said that we should make it similar to the alcohol beverage services and sales training, so that there needs to be some training of these people,
right,
which talks about, you know, identifying when people are impaired and not being able to sell to people when they are impaired, right? So So your bartenders can get in a lot of trouble if they continue to serve alcohol to somebody that's impaired. There's a requirement of this, of marijuana people. So,
well, I think there's got to be some consequences. I mean, when you're selling a product and then the person goes out in the parking lot and gets high before they leave, I mean, criminy sakes, I had a guy come in the other day that brought back a part in a box. And when I looked in the box, it was like the air from inside of his car came out. And it was like, holy cow, I think I just got high.
And you do realize, I don't know if it's happened in this state yet, but other states have deemed that an officer can't use the smell of marijuana in their car as an indicator that they may be using marijuana in the car. Even though it's illegal to use the marijuana in the car is what we voted on in Prop 64 and said, you know, it needs to be in the trunk and passengers can't be using, because, again, you can, as you said, get a secondhand high. But yet they tried to create a bus delivery system where they would drive them from one drug den to another drug den and have a bus driver. And then they tried to say, well, we're going to put them in an oxygen chamber, I guess. drive down the street.
Welcome to your alternate universe.
Yeah, so I don't know how exactly that would
Dr. Drum, are they allowed to, I mean, if you roll down your window, if you get pulled over, you roll down your window and you smell like beer, aren't you? I mean, then they're giving you a sobriety test. I mean, they're allowed to smell alcohol, right?
I believe so. In fact, it was Tiger Woods, who's a notorious person that's had multiple events with marijuana in his impaired driving.
Oh, that explains a lot.
The sheriff Dylan Nueva said that he had smelled. That the officer had smelled his breath and said that there was no alcohol emanating from his breath. I guess the question I'd have for that officer would be, what does a gummy of THC smell like?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And that if you're relying on smell to be your only option, because, again, I'm sure they didn't do a nine-step walk and turn. He had a broken ankle. So they didn't do all of the field sobriety tests, but Sheriff Villanueva was adamant that he was not impaired, and they didn't draw blood.
It's a good way to make sure you never find out.
So the state should provide guidelines for advertisers displaying cannabis-related products, which include a legal consumption age for the cannabis, and information related to the risk of impaired driving. And I would encourage this to be put on all of our billboards. And I would encourage it to be 50% of the billboard needs to be the hazards and warnings of that marijuana. If you're going to put it on the roadway, let's warn the consumption puts people at risk for impaired, because they have to put it on their product right now, which, of course, people don't read, where it says you're not to operate in heavy machinery or a car. That's required by the state to be on the product.
Well, for heaven's sakes, I mean, your grocery store bag tells you not to put the bag over your head, you know, which I would think would be fairly obvious. To put a warning on a drug, that doesn't seem like a heavy lift.
Yeah, so but I would also it is on the drug. I'm telling you now. Prop 64 says it has to be on the product.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be on the billboard. So this section talks about advertising. So that's why I'm saying it should be on the billboard.
But didn't they also say they couldn't do billboards?
No, I'm saying they can.
They can. Okay.
They can do billboards except for those that cross state borders right now, and they're trying to pass a bill urgently that will allow on all of our highways.
Wow.
So they're upset that they don't have it on all of our highways right now. So they're trying to get it on all of them. They're not satisfied with having it on 680, 880, 580, 405, 105. In fact, they even said it. How come I can have it on 405, but I can't have it on I-5? That's what they said at the Senate Transportation Committee.
And some people are playing this off like a freedom or First Amendment issue.
Right, and tobacco doesn't have the same. Tobacco, you know, agreed to not have advertisements. Do you see tobacco ads on the billboards anymore?
Well, no, and that was my next question. It's like how I guess my money's on tobacco suing marijuana.
I would hope so. I would hope that they would sue the state, actually. They don't have to sue.
Right, but
marijuana, sue the state and say, why are you discriminating against us?
Right, for discrimination, sure.
Because you are allowing the marijuana industry to do this, but you're not allowing us. I'm sure they're going to come back, the state attorney general, who lost that case again down in Santa Barbara get the billboards off the highway. They're going to probably continue to try and protect the marijuana industry because they're going to say, you, the tobacco industry, signed that agreement that would not, that would force you to put that dangerous information on your billboard. I'm just saying, let's be equal to the tobacco industry and do the same.
Yeah,
and
no kidding.
The marijuana industry, just like the tobacco industry, to put the warnings up on those billboards, I can guarantee you that will make the billboards go away.
Yeah, because they don't want to put a warning up on there.
They don't want to have to put up the risk of suicide, the risk of the driving issues, the low birth weight children, all of those things that are documented scientific evidence.
Or just the numbers, how many people were killed by the guy next to you who just got done smoking pot. So,
right.
Really quick break here, and then we're going to come back and pick right up where we left off. Sorry. Free enterprise, but at least we're not advertising pot. Yay. We will be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Tell me why it's a land of confusion.
Apparently, we already know. We just need to get the other half of the billboard up there so we can explain it to the rest of the people.
Well, they probably couldn't read it if you did.
Honestly, though, like on the way in this morning, or I guess it was technically almost afternoon, it was just mind-blowing. And people going really fast, and they go really slow. It isn't just your usual, did you fail driver's ed, you know, thing. A lot of the driving is really kind of inexplicable. And I don't know. Do you have any idea? Is there any way to even know, Dr. Drum, how many people out there are driving after they've been involved with marijuana?
Well, again, there have been some studies, like Washington looked at the studies where they asked people to voluntarily commit to an oral swab to test, and it went from 10% of the drivers to 20% after legalization. So there have been some studies that have looked at this. They also did another study in which the marijuana industry is saying, see, it's not a problem. In Virginia, where we happen to have a major naval base, and of course those people know that they can't be using marijuana. So, you do need to make sure that when you do a study, you do it fairly. But if I could just roll through a few more of our recommendations, I hit some major ones here that we discussed. Warnings regarding the dangers of impaired driving. The risk of underage marijuana use and possible risk associated with poly substance use. Again, as I mentioned before, alcohol and marijuana is the largest combination product out there, reported nationally. Even 50% of the fatalities are speeding. Cannabis consumption sites shall provide information regarding locally available alternate transportation to all consumers. That was something that I definitely pushed for in our group, which, of course, the marijuana industry did not want. And it was changed to a should. Really, this needs to be done. If you're going to allow them to use on a site, how are they going to get home? And I would cite the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's report from 2016, which I gave to other members of the committee, the entire committee had this, that reported findings of scientific literature that supported waiting 6 hours after smoking 18 milligrams of THC for those who use less than weekly, and waiting 8 hours to be able to drive, following consumption or oral ingestion of 18 milligrams of THC.
And what is that equivalent to?
So let me go through that. So let's say you have a 23% joint. That 23% joint, about a half a gram, is about 115 then milligrams of THC. 115. I just told you 18 milligrams.
Yeah.
So that means you and 5.4 of your best friends would need to consume that joint for you to get 18 milligrams. So 6.4 people need to consume that 23% joint. You can imagine how many people need to consume that 60, 90% vape pen. Okay? And 80 milligrams, say 80 milligrams in a cookie, you need to eat less than a quarter of that cookie to get 18 milligrams, right? A quarter of it would be 20. So if you only get a quarter of the cookie, you've eaten 20 milligrams. That's too much. So how are these people going to get home following use at a consumption site? That's why I said Shell provide locally available alternate transportation to get home. We have Uber, Lyft. We have ways that they can get home. They should be taking the keys away just like they do to somebody that's impaired driving, that the bartender is responsible if they get in the car and they're impaired. They need to call a cab. They need to get another way of getting home. Again, I reminded AAA to educate people about how they, on New Year's Eve, help people get home. You call their telephone number and they'll get somebody to drive you home if you're impaired. So, we need to have that. Well, we need to have age-appropriate education for youth on the impacts of impaired driving. We need to have training opportunities for the legal system and judiciary system who seem to not understand the hazard with this. And so we need them to be fully aware of what's going on out in the roadways that's bringing people into the court system. That within 2 years of being appointed and annually thereafter, all criminal justice officers, judges, defense attorneys, and prosecutors should receive training which covers addiction, drug abuse, behavior modifications, factors contributing to impairment. And of course, the marijuana industry wanted bias in arrests and prosecution to be added as well. The state should be providing training to persons working in the medical and pharmacy fields regarding the dangers of impaired driving by alcohol, cannabis, prescription drugs, and over-the-counter drugs. I think really most pharmacists already know this. They may not know as much about cannabis as I do, but I know our medical community is not that aware of the major hazards, especially with the drug-drug interaction issues that go on between legitimate drugs and cannabis. They're numerous and very hazardous. The DMV, we gave the DMV a responsibility. Shall require traffic schools to add information about the dangers of cannabis or marijuana and drug impairment to their curriculum and include a victims impact panel component with their courses. I know I personally could never be a victims impact person to go in because I happen to know the recidivism rate with this is astronomical for those people that are already impaired driving. In fact, the guy that murdered my sister had multiple DUIs before he killed her. He had two felonies regarding marijuana before he killed her. And even after he spent a little over 2 years of his 4.5-year sentence and got out of jail, he went on to commit another DUI after getting out of jail for killing my sister. So that just kind of shows you how concerned they are and how they tend then to not be a recidivist. They do a lot. Law enforcement recommendations, we had information. This is the other thing I think is going to be very startling to you. Do you realize that someone can go through peace officer standard and training and not be required to understand or know how to perform standard field sobriety tests?
No.
That's bizarre.
I didn't know that either. There's 16 hours that needs to be done to be able to train them appropriately. And these people are getting out of their law enforcement academies in California without that. California Highway Patrol did reiterate multiple times that we require it, but others do not. Others do not. That should be a required skill, especially sure. For anybody that's out on the roadway, that they should know how to be able to perform standard field sobriety tests. All enforcement officer personnel assigned to traffic enforcement responsibilities shall receive A-RIDE training. That's Advanced Roadside Impaired Drug Enforcement. Training within 1 year of being assigned and biannually continuing education related to impaired driving. So this is an additional course. It's a couple-day course that then delves more into whereas the standard field sobriety test is primarily talking about alcohol and showing them how to do the 9-step walk and turn, the finger to nose, what modified Romberg, those types of things, looking, look at the tip of my finger, those types of things. The A-Ride training teaches them more about the drugs and which drugs cause which impairment. And so we're saying anybody that is assigned to traffic enforcement responsibilities, they have that training too. They need to have that training too. Okay? The CHP and California Office of Transportation Safety should make all efforts to increase the number of drug recognition evaluators, or DREs. Now, DREs are even more specially trained officers that have to go further, 2 full weeks further of education to be more educated on being able to identify impaired drivers. And so these are the people that they may call in. Unfortunately, it takes them sometimes a long time to show up to the site, even while some people are starting to now become less impaired. So that's why we need more of these on the road. That we don't have enough DREs on our roadway. And so the recommendation was that they should increase by 4% per year for the next 5 years. So 4% per year for 5 years is a 20% increase, about. Would it not be?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this report was actually in the final version said 4% over 5 years. There's a little bit of a difference there, isn't there?
Yeah.
So that's why I say we need to enact what the content experts were recommending. In fact, we discussed this with the California Highway Patrol on how difficult this would be, and they actually talked about, the next one talked about, should receive incentive pay to be DRE trained, because these people get the DRE training, and then they told us they tended to move on into other forms of law enforcement and no longer used that specialized training that they received, so that if we gave them incentive pay, then they would tend to stick around in traffic enforcement. So I would strongly encourage that. Well, law enforcement should use best available roadside presumptive screening devices and confirmation tests in the most expedient manner for possible drug and alcohol impaired driving investigations. And so we weren't specific here. However, I think the information that's available in many, many, many other states, that oral swabs, oral fluid testing for drugs is available. In fact, they've done it twice here in the state of California. They've already done it twice, where they've looked at oral swab testing for drugs, and this looks for opiates, THC, methamphetamine, multiple different drug substances, cocaine, that they can quickly identify within 5 to 7 minutes whether somebody's been impaired, has been exposed to that substance. And in which there was a study in 2013 that looked at over 4,500 drivers looking at oral swabs and blood data. And they found that the oral swab tests were accurate for marijuana in over 98%, 98.6% of the cases, and that it was oral swab was highly valid for detecting the presence of THC in blood, but not accurate measure of blood levels. So, again, it's a measure to see its presence in the body. And, again, we use the totality of evidence to convict someone, not a blood level, especially not for a drug. In fact, the Department of Transportation does not use blood presence. So DOT Rule 49 CFR Code of Federal Regulations Part 40 uses urine testing for all drugs other than alcohol. So these are being done, they're performed in safety-sensitive groups. Well, who are those? Well, people like school bus drivers and interstate truckers are under this, but not your standard driver. That's a problem, because a standard driver could take out a school bus. In fact, I have video evidence from the NTSB that one did and killed 13 people in Texas. Okay? And so why I would encourage you, Aaron, to get, you know, Congressman LaMalfa, who sits on the Transportation Committee, to please put forward a bill to enact the DOT Rule 49 CFR Part 40 for all drivers in the United States of America, that we can then use urine testing for PCP, opiate, marijuana, cocaine, amphetamine. We should be doing that.
And DOT rule what? You said that kind of quick.
So it's Rule 49.
Yes.
Code of Federal Regulations, Part 40. That is the Department of Transportation rule that stipulates how to test somebody for impairment. So if they're a pilot, an airplane mechanic, a boat captain, they're under that rule. A school bus driver and an interstate trucker, but not your SUV driver, not your sports car driver driving down the street. Okay? Right. Why not? Well, and so I would encourage that we do that. Again, oral swabs are used in many other countries and have been so for decades. It was 2019 that Scotland just adopted it, but in 2015, England and Wales had already adopted oral swabs as a measure for having zero tolerance. So if it was positive in the oral swab, they would ban somebody up to driving for a year. They could, or have £5,000 fine. It could be up to 14-year prison sentence for a death as the result of driving under the influence. So many other countries take this very seriously. Unfortunately, ours is not. Again, our state is not even using oral swabs. There was an oral swab study that was done in Michigan that they first started it in 5 counties. They resulted in 92 tests that were done over 1 year period. They did 92 times with the DRE. It resulted in 89 arrests. 73 of the 92 were positive for THC.
Wow.
The next so testing positive, how does that translate to actually being impaired?
So for them to be able to have pulled somebody over, again, it's that totality of the evidence, they have to see somebody driving impaired.
Okay.
They're not just pulling people over and say, let me swab you, right?
Yeah, so, they were swerving, so they were going reckless.
There's a presumption here that they're exhibiting actions of potentially being impaired.
Okay.
And so with their actions, with their failed standard field sobriety test, and oh, by the way, standard field sobriety tests were found to be very active in predicting. Again, the 2016 study, 302 toxicologically confirmed marijuana positive people. DRE officers were able to predict marijuana 96.7% of the time correctly. 96.7% of the time in 302. There was a 2016 Orange County study in Southern California. 5,000 drivers suspected of DUI. So again, this is what you're alluding to, Bill. These are guys driving down the road. So from 2010 to 2016, over 5,000 drivers, their final conclusion was the standard field sobriety tests were sensitive to marijuana positivity. There was no correlation between the standard field sobriety test to the blood of THC. So again, we should not be using blood. Blood loses 90%. You lose 90% of THC in blood after consumption, 90% in the blood within 80 minutes. On average, a study, it takes 2 hours to draw blood when there is a death or an assault. So when there's mayhem on the road, it takes a while to draw blood. If you're drawing blood 2 hours later, you've lost well more than 90% of the THC. Because, again, we know THC is fat-soluble. THC is residing in your brain, which is the largest fat-soluble organ in your body. It's not staying in the blood system because blood is water. So it is quickly leaving the bloodstream and going into the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why blood is not effective. Oral swabs would be to show presence in the body. Again, there was a Del Bozzo study that also looked at urine. And in 2018, they showed that if they found the metabolites in the urine, which again is in the Department of Transportation rule, they used the same values as the U.S. Department of Transportation in Italy. And they looked and saw a tenfold increase in crashes when people had the marijuana positivity to the level that's seen in the Department of Transportation. So yes, urine levels are effective in identifying a risk of a marijuana impaired driver.
Nice. When we come back, I'd like to know if you have any information on the cost, because when they initially talked about blood tests and stuff like that, it was like, oh, this is just cost prohibitive. But it sounds to me like the whole swab thing and all that might be easy and less expensive and quick to implement. So be curious about that. Our guest is Dr. Philip Drumm, and we are talking about, make sure I get it correct, the Impaired Driving Task Force. The recommendations and all of that are posted online for you. Please take them and use them. You can always use anything on our website, pictures, articles we post, things from our guests. Please make use of all of that information. You can find it all at
wethepeopleradio.us.
It's all going to prop. take those pills, friend, it's all going to pot. I got a $100 bill, you can keep your pills, friend, but it's all going to pot.
The pills, no smoking the pills, that make me feel okay. You go down easy, baby. I could drink you by the case. You're my painkiller. A little dose of you goes a long, long way. You're my painkiller. Oh, you take it away.
There you go, Bill. That's for you.
Oh,
you're my painkiller.
Oh, thank
That's
you.
That's why I'm not smoking on the weed. Or...
Smoking on the weed.
I got Bill.
There you are.
He's my painkiller. Oh, man. So we needed to mention, Dr. Drum, that Assembly Bill 1302, Louise sent me a little note here, is going to be voted on August 16th here in California. That would be the Commercial Cannabis Billboards Placement Restrictions Bill. Please call your California senator to vote no when it goes to the floor. And the vote is slated for, again, possibly August 16th. So if you live in California, call your state senator and let them know that Bill 1302, the billboards, the cannabis billboards, would be a no vote in your opinion.
And I just wanted to add about that. That is additional pot billboards. It's not – so there are already pot billboards that are already in Prop 64.
Mm-hmm.
It's just those that cross the state border cannot have them on them. So they – again, the bottom line is AB 1302 is going to let them have them on all highways except for 15 miles from the border. So they want to – they desperately want them on I-5. I-80, those that go across the United States. So that's what 1302 is only going to keep them off of I-5 and I-80, just to be clear.
Okay.
You asked the question about cost of this program, and I'd love to bring up the cost of a driving fatality. It was estimated to be about $1.3 million at about 3 driving deaths in the state of California. That's about 1,000 driving deaths due to marijuana in our state alone. Multiply that times probably about a $1.6 million per life lost now. So that kind of adds up as to how much this costs our society when you kill somebody due to a marijuana-impaired driver. But just from a financial standpoint, let me go back to the state of Michigan issue. Again, Michigan had a bill in 2016 introduced. They then ran their study from November 2017 to November 2018. They did it in 5 counties. They did 92 tests. They looked back at the data, brought it back, and they overwhelmingly supported in February 2019 to expand this to all 46 counties at a cost of $626,000.
Wow.
For $500,000, do you think it would be a good idea? It's going to cost a little bit more because we have more people and more officers in this state, but it's just a $500,000 to increase it to all of their state DREs. So not too expensive. It also is not too expensive if we would have enacted AB 551, which was going to require coroners and medical examiners to perform drug tests on driving fatalities. This was vetoed by Governor Gavin Newsom in 2019. The marijuana industry had them take out THC. The bill said shall include but not limited to the following drugs, and it had THC, it had methamphetamine, it had opiates, it had other drugs that were going to be tested for. Marijuana strongly objected to that, and they had them take out THC. Well, they subsequently used the fact that THC was taken out, but again, the line said shall include but not limited to. So THC was actually still in the bill, but Governor Gavin Newsom used the fact that marijuana wasn't in the bill in his veto vote, saying, oh, marijuana's not in the bill anymore, and it needs to be in there. But we're going to leave it to the discretion of our coroners to be testing for this. That's a $300 test. That's about $3,000 to do an autopsy. So who gets paid the $3,000 from the state? The coroner does. Are they willing to do the $300 drug test? No. I told you they were only doing it 20% of the time. 1,000 out of 5,000 deaths. That's why we need to mandate it. We need to make it shall do this, not should, shall. And that is one of our recommendations under the California Highway Patrol recommendations, is that we need to introduce back that law, a law that will force the coroners to look for drugs because they're not doing it. We also recommended that video or audio recording devices be used. So at the roadside, so Bill, if you're concerned, you know, pulling people up, we'll have it on video, or preferably, I'd say, audio or video. Most officers have cameras. So let's videotape the person when they're performing their field sobriety test so we can show the jury them failing their field sobriety test. So that way there's no question as to the officer's veracity in saying that the person's failing their field sobriety test. The judge and jury can see it for themselves.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
So that's one of our recommendations. We also asked to consider having law enforcement perform phlebotomy at the roadside. This is not unheard of. Arizona does it now. So why not have police officers performing the phlebotomy? We don't have to bring them into the hospital. It's taking hours before they get it done. They could do it at the roadside. Or what Texas did was brought somebody to the site. They actually had a legal person as well as a phlebotomist come out to the site, and they cut their driving fatality rates in half 2 years in a row.
Oh, no kidding.
People stopped driving impaired because they knew they were going to get caught because the phlebotomies now were being done at the roadside. That's a great way to catch them.
And when you say phlebotomy, how much blood are we talking about here? I mean, is it just a finger prick, or is it a needle?
It would be just like what they do to draw blood for, a sodium level or cholesterol level. At the roadside, that they would draw some blood, a tablespoon to a couple tablespoons of blood.
You just guaranteed Bill's never, ever, ever even going to drive in a car with anyone who might have said the word marijuana.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring up a couple other. There's another testing mechanism that's out there. It's got a little bit of a problem. It's the breath test. As you know, they do a breath test for alcohol. It's easy for a two-carbon molecule for them to do this and equate the amount that's in the blood with what's in the brain. But we have a 21-carbon fat-soluble molecule in THC. And so, like I said, it doesn't stick around in the blood very well. It does come out in the urine. It does come out in the saliva. And it does come out in the breath. But unfortunately, I know one of the researchers here trying to do a breath test for marijuana and saying, well, I got it up to catching it 2 hours after use. And I said, that's not long enough. I told you earlier, 6 hours for smoked, 8 hours for an edible. And that's if you're an infrequent user. If you're a chronic user, you're actually chronically impaired because it's staying in your brain and causing impairment. And people's own actions, they've proven this, that they may ask them, do you feel impaired? They're not able to accurately predict their own impairment. Let me add one more thing. Per se limits, this is one of the toxicology recommendations, and some members, again, they were researchers, and they like the idea, and even the legal system loves the idea of having a number, which, oh, by the way, is 0.08 for alcohol, and the recommendation by the NTSB since 2013 is to lower it to 0.05. Utah's already taken them up on it, but nobody else has. I'd strongly encourage for this state to also go down to 0.05, because one of the marijuana studies showed that they were drawing blood at the time that the person was driving, and they were committing weaving in a simulated driver, and that THC blood level was 13.1. Again, about an hour, two hours later, that level becomes two. So again, that level of two or three really should be what we're looking at, because at 13.1, by the time you draw blood 2 hours later, it's about two or three. Okay? And so they looked at it, so 13.1 of THC was equivalent to the 0.08 weaving. But then they did a combination of alcohol and marijuana, and they saw that 0.05 of alcohol plus 5 nanograms of THC at the time of driving, which would probably become undetectable an hour to 2 hours later. That 5 would be virtually nothing and would be unable to be detected with 5. So, again, it's the combination that's really dangerous, very common. And one last statement I'd like to make to have everybody really think about this. California Governor Gavin Newsom and the California legislature is playing Russian roulette every day with your life. by not addressing the issue of marijuana-impaired driving. Every marijuana user is like adding another bullet to the gun. 9 years ago, it was my sister that got killed driving to work. Will you or your loved one be next? Only making a severe consequence for such reckless behavior will things change. The task force is done. We created our 30 recommendations. It's time for the legislature and executive branch in this state to act. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, sure.
You know, anybody who thinks this is all victimless and it's just about people who have medical issues and all that other crazy stuff, it's like you've completely missed the point.
Right.
The organized crime, the roadway fatalities, the lack of, I mean, you know, I don't think there's any confusion about why we have all these people who are not in the workforce, you know. When we showed how many people increased their drug use, drug abuse, and overdosing last year. So you have, oh, we've made marijuana completely, you know, acceptable, sure, available. And now suddenly they don't want to go to work. Gee whiz,
well,
who could have seen that coming?
And they can't pass a drug test.
And there's that.
I mean, there's so many people.
Amazon said they're not going to test their workers.
Really?
Look it up.
They've just given up?
Look it up.
They just basically throw in the towel on that one. So we do have like another minute and a half or something like that, but so we don't run up against it. I just want to thank you for this. You are a wealth of information on this, and I would really hope that people would go to the website, listen to your previous shows, because they've all been different and really, really interesting. We really appreciate you sticking on this topic as tightly as you have and bringing all this. Because, you know, it's one thing for the rest of us to say we think it's a problem, but you can actually prove it. In the last minute or so, can you give a quick snippet on the whole medical thing? Just, you know, people saying, oh, well, we have to have it for medical purposes, just from the pharmacy standpoint?
Sure. Again, I guess the key question is, do you realize the Food and Drug Administration has already approved the psychoactive component in 1985? It's called dronabinol, also known as Marinol, and it very, very rarely gets used. So the lie was that we needed it for medical purposes in 1996. We already had it. We also now have CBD for medical purposes. So Mitch McConnell approving the hemp bill, which was used to create CBD, which is being sold in gas stations and everywhere, Bed Bath & Beyond, and et cetera, that we have CBD, medically approved CBD. For very rare seizure syndromes for CBD, for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, and it doesn't work very well for that, and AIDS wasting syndrome for THC. So the indications are minuscule for the appropriate indications. The pain that it's being used for has repeatedly, whether it be cancer pain or non-cancer pain, it does not work.